Okay, so what does the world tell us about the beginning of the universe? What's the common theory of the world? Why? There it is, that's right. There was a Big Bang, right? Oh, there was a Big Bang, all right. May not have been able to hear it in a vacuum, but let's hear just a nice 3-minute description of the Big Bang by John Lennox, who's the pastor emeritus of mathematics at Oxford. And just consider this, because when Dave gets up and starts speaking about the cosmos, be thinking about this agent, this first action that created all things. Let's listen to this. Oops. We try that again. Here you go, Derek. You got me audio.
The Big Bang
there you go.
Does not disprove the need for God or creator. That's a confusion of thought. The Big Bang is simply telling us we believe there was a beginning. That is what Genesis has been saying for thousands of years. The point is, Genesis is not only telling us that there was a beginning, it is also telling us what science cannot tell us, the ultimate cause of that beginning, which is God. So a Christian has nothing to fear from people using the words Big Bang, although, as I said earlier, they are misleading. You think of an explosion that makes a noise, which is very far from the basic idea. But let's grasp the central thing, which I find is marvelous. Because, as I've often said to physicists, look, it took you till the 1960s to come to believe that the universe had a beginning. I actually believed it myself before you did, because I have reasons for thinking that the biblical revelation is true. And what is more, if you had taken seriously the worldview of the Bible and weren't so committed to Aristotle, you might have looked for evidence for a beginning to space-time much earlier than you did. Now, this is very important because many scientists say, well, the Bible makes no predictions. Well, that's not quite true, because if you take its worldview seriously, here at the very start, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, if that's true, you can test it. And this is exactly what happened through Lemaître, Hubble, and Penzias and Wilson. They were testing something that the Bible had stated. And isn't it interesting? It was Georges Lemaître, a priest, who first led them to the idea.
So if there is such a thing as a Big Bang, a creation that way, that God would have done it, does that mean that the Bible's wrong? No, actually, you've got to have a first action to have a reaction. So you have to have something 1 second before the quote-unquote Big Bang or whatever happened. So it doesn't disprove God. And so what does the Bible tell us in the first 5 verses? Well, let's just look at the very first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That is time, matter, and energy. When was it created? The beginning. What was created? Space and matter. And who did it? Boom. Okay. That's good, because we need that. But what's fascinating, we need that description because we need to know who was the first action for the reaction. We need to know who the creative agent was. It was God himself. What is the word of God? What is the name of God he used to describe himself as the first name? Does anybody know? Special credit for those who paid attention in Sunday school. It is Elohim, which is plural. So he starts right off by saying, guys, I'm the all-powerful creator God. I am the plural God. I am Trinitarian in nature. So what's fascinating about this is, from a science perspective, is what are the characteristics of water, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and what states does it exist in, and light. Water and light are in these first two verses. Is there a sun yet? Not everybody at once. It's hard to control this thing. Okay, all right. No, there is no light yet. Who's the light? Yeah, Jesus is. That's right. John 1 says he's the light. He's the life of men. That's right. He's the light of the world. And when we get to Revelation, we'll talk about this later when we get to the hope, we're going to talk about that lamb becomes a shepherd, and that lamb is the light of heaven, and there is no need for a sun anymore. So this is the Shekinah glory of God. All you need for a day is rotation. So you have a water ball of earth spinning. You need rotation and him shining his own glory on this, and that's all you need. And we're even told that that spirit is hovering over the waters. So he said, let there be light, and he shines his glory on this rotating sphere we call earth. And he saw the light, and it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and that was the first day. And his first name he uses for himself is Elohim, which is plural, which he's telling you right out of the gate, there's a Trinity. I always liked Adrian Rogers' description of the Trinity. You try and understand the Trinity fully, you lose your mind. If you deny it, you lose your soul. So it's fascinating. He points out to us, and he uses two characteristics, two elements here, water and light. What's unique about water is it exists in three states. And what's unique about light is you have a visible spectrum we see through the atmosphere, and you have the invisible spectrum on the ultraviolet side, which are very fast waves, and on the other side, you have very slow waves, which are what you would call infrared, or you feel in its heat. So they're both Trinitarian, if you will, in the way that they break down. And that's the first two elements that he creates. And so to your point, John 1, who was the light of the world? Jesus was. We kind of have a restatement and a recap of that in John 1:1, where we talk about in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's Jesus. And he was the light of men. He was the life, and he was the light of men. Notice he uses this, and we beheld his glory, the Shekinah glory term that we heard in Genesis 1. Let's talk about water and how special it is, because it is super unique, and it is exactly, from a science perspective, what you'd expect to see as the first element for life.
It covers nearly three quarters of our planet, and it's essential for our existence. Water is a thing of wonder and inspiration. It also happens to be uniquely fit for creatures like us. One key feature of water that promotes life is its capacity to act as a universal solvent. Water can dissolve almost anything. This allows it to be an ideal carrier of the many chemicals and minerals we need for life. At the same time, water is less chemically reactive than many other solvents. Sulfuric acid can dissolve minerals, but it also destroys them by reacting with them and making them useless for life. Water dissolves minerals without destroying them, allowing them to carry out their life-giving functions. Water is thus an ideal solvent for life. Another important feature of water that enables life is its low viscosity or thickness. Different liquids can have radically different viscosities. Tar has a much higher viscosity than olive oil, and olive oil has a much higher viscosity than water. Water has one of the lowest viscosities of any common liquid, and its viscosity seems just right to facilitate life like ours. If the viscosity of water were any lower, like the viscosity of liquid hydrogen, the delicate microscopic structures in our cells wouldn't survive when subjected to outside forces. On the other hand, if water's viscosity were even slightly higher, the pumping of blood through the tiny capillaries which permeate all the organs in the body would be impossible, and our circulatory system wouldn't be able to supply enough oxygen or glucose to our muscle tissues for organisms like us to survive. In sum, the viscosity of water seems to be finely tuned for life like us. But perhaps the most striking features of water that make life possible are its thermal properties, which help us deal with the impact of heat. Many biochemical processes essential for life can only operate within a narrow band of temperatures. If the temperature is too high or too low, these biochemical processes cease to function, and life like ours becomes impossible. Thus, maintaining stable temperatures on the Earth and inside ourselves is essential for us to exist. Water is critical to maintaining stable temperatures. Water has a high heat capacity, which means that it can absorb large amounts of heat with only a relatively small increase in its temperature. You can see this in everyday life. Walk barefoot on sand on a hot summer's day, and you'll likely burn your feet. Place your feet in a swimming pool during the same summer day, and the water will only be pleasantly warm. Water's high capacity for absorbing heat helps both our planet and our bodies to maintain a stable temperature range.
You have to put a lot of energy into water to change the temperature. That's very convenient. It means it's very easy for warm-blooded organisms like ourselves to maintain body temperature. So that's a property of water which seems specifically fit for beings like ourselves. And but there's another property of water which might even be more critical, and that is that, in fact, the evaporative cooling of water is one of the greatest of any fluid that's known.
The human metabolism produces large amounts of heat that needs to be discharged, or the body will overheat and die. The evaporation of water through perspiration is one of the key ways our body gets rid of excess heat. Water is especially fit for the task of cooling us because it absorbs a large amount of heat when it evaporates. In fact, more heat is absorbed by the evaporation of water than by the evaporation of almost any other known fluid at ambient temperatures and pressures. Water is uniquely suited to help us shed excess heat in hot climates. When the outside temperatures exceed the level of your body temperature, other ways of getting rid of heat won't work.
Because the only way to lose heat when the environment around you is reaching sort of 38 degrees centigrade is by evaporative cooling. Because you can't radiate the heat out because the environment is 38 degrees warmer than you, right? So it's absolutely critical to warm-blooded organisms like ourselves that the evaporative cooling of water is very high. It's one of the highest of any known common fluid.
The high evaporative cooling of water appears to benefit humans more than any other animal. Being relatively hairless, humans lose heat through evaporative cooling more efficiently than any other mammal. Consequently, in the heat of the day, humans can exert themselves continuously for longer periods of time than other mammals. Another intriguing thermal property of water is its peculiar behavior when freezing. Most liquids contract as they freeze, making their solid form denser than their liquid form. Unlike virtually every other liquid, however, water expands when it freezes, making frozen water less dense than liquid water. That's why ice floats. This special property of water helps preserve it in its liquid state. If water acted like most other liquids, oceans and lakes would freeze from the bottom up until there was no liquid left. Most of the Earth would be permanently encased in ice, making life as we know it impossible. Instead, when ice forms on the top of water, it creates a protective lid that insulates the water underneath it from the cold, keeping it in its liquid state.
So you can see right there the design for using water as a first substance is what you need to begin with life. And the properties it has, being vapor or solid as when it's in frozen state or liquid, are also requirements that we would need for us to live. So it's a very unique thing. In and of itself, it's Trinitarian in nature. And so is light. Jesus said he was the light of the world, and we have these verses of light or the Shekinah glory of God in the first verse. But we have, again, these ultraviolet rays that are very fast, and they're very harmful, actually, but only in very small bands Are they useful to us? And that's the very small sliver that we get that comes through when Michael speaks on the atmosphere and the design of that. But what do we use ultraviolet light for? We use it for, during COVID, have you guys seen those ultraviolet lamps we use? What do? They kill bacteria and other things. And they actually kill harmful bacteria and things that would impact the plant population. So you need a little bit of it, but not very much. And if you have too much of it, you're dead. So, but that these are invisible to our eyes, this ultraviolet spectrum and radio spectrum. And on the other side, so this side, you see, is quick and has a property of destroying bacteria and other things. And on this side, it's very slow on the infrared side. And that's when you put your hand up to a lamp and you can feel it. That's heat. And then there's the visible spectrum, which is what we can see. And there's a Trinitarian kind of quality here as well, with infrared being something you can feel, something you can see, and something you can't see, but in small doses is actually a really good thing because it can kill things that are bad for you. But isn't it fascinating that we have Elohim and we have water and light, and we have, from a science perspective, this depth of scientific importance that comes along with these. We get now to the second day. Okay, and we're going to have Michael come and do atmosphere, and actually third day too. We're going to put these together.
Well, let me tell you just a little bit about Dr. Binhauser. Anyway, his wife Heather is here. They have four children, Michael. I didn't know the older ones. Yeah, so four children. And one thing you need to know about Michael is that he was an evolutionist coming up through school and now is a young earth creationist. Michael, take us through days two and three.
Okay. I don't think I'm on. Am I? Yep. Okay. I think sometimes I'm the master of the obvious, because I look at the world and I say, you know, I didn't make the world and I don't maintain it. I just live in it. You know, I cut the grass or whatever. The grass does what it normally does, you know. Seed reseeds itself. I didn't make life. God made life and passed it on. God has life in himself and is the only one that could start life, because he had life and he passed it on. He created living things that are not biblically alive, but then did create others like us that are biblically alive. And so we want to talk tonight about the atmosphere. But, you know, we said before that we take Genesis 1 through 11 as history. And we do that because God is truth and cannot lie. And so when God says things, using words to say those things, words have meanings, and they have definite meanings within a historical, grammatical context. And without that guide, then words have no meaning, right? And so if God inspired the scriptures, including Genesis 1 through 11, then he said what he meant, and we should pay attention to the words that he used and what he says. And so we interpret Genesis 1 through 11 in the historical, grammatical, and plain, some would say literal, but plain is a better term for our understanding of Genesis, and indeed the whole Bible. And as we start this study, you know, it's like climbing a mountain. You don't climb a mountain all in one afternoon, generally. It takes days and days and days. So you climb a little bit one day and climb a little bit more the next day. And this information is a big mountain, the information about creation. And if you would climb as high as you can and then take a rest and then come back to the information and maybe climb a little higher, and you'll get new insights and you'll learn new things. It's not something that you can just get in a weekend. Hopefully you'll get some new things, but, you know, keep climbing. ask your questions and see if we can answer your questions. I also want to note that on our website, genesisacademy.net, we have a link to my podcast. And so I have a new podcast called Science and You. And these are, right now, they're 5-minute episodes. And it's on Google Podcasts, it's on Spotify, it's on Apple iTunes, it's on various other platforms. But you can get to it from the link on the first page of the Genesis Academy website. We're going to talk about days 2 and 3. All right, so day 2 is the only day where God didn't say, and it was very good, it was good. And God did this, and it was good. And that was morning and evening, whatever day, the second day. God didn't say it was good. And why is that? You should ask yourself that. And then day 3, we have the drawing together of the waters and into the seas, and the land appearing, and then we have land plants. This is the first appearance of life on earth. Now, this is not biblical life. This is not Naphesh life. This is biological life, but it is important. And when we go through what God says in His Word, and especially this word firmament, which is otherwise known as an expanse, I want you to be aware of something. So the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and then it was translated into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. Then the Greek was translated into Latin, and it's called the Vulgate. And when they did that translation, those translations, the Septuagint used this word called stereoma, which had the sense of being hard or firm, for this term, firmament. Let's see if I can get there. Yeah, firmament. And then the Vulgate translated stereoma into Latin as fermentum or fermentarum. So this is where then in the King James you get the English of firmament. It's a transliteration of what was in the Vulgate, which came from the Septuagint, which translated the Hebrew word rakia, which has a different meaning than firm and solid. The meaning of the original term in Hebrew refers to something that's actually flexible and movable and can be stretched out. And the emphasis in that word is on the space in between, stretching. And so Genesis 1, verses 6 through 8, this is the second day, God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." So this is more properly thought of as an expanse, a space, right? A gap of dividing waters from waters, not something firm and hard, because that is not the meaning of the original Hebrew word. And thus God made the firmament, this space, and divided the waters which were under the firmament, firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so, and God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and morning, the second day. So you notice He doesn't say it was good, because He's not done yet. It's not fully the way He wants it to be. So there's a process that God was going through in days 2 and 3 to create not only the atmosphere on earth, but a place probably out in the heavens for the sun, the moon, and the stars. That's also called the expanse of heaven. And also to then create and then have an environment of solid land on which He could begin to place life. And so when you get to the end of day 3, God actually says it was good twice. Kind of makes up for the one that He didn't say on day 2, because day 3, now it is the way He wants it to be. It's complete in the way that He wants it. All right, so what was the firmament? What was it? It was an expansion of something. And we don't really know what that was, but you know, there had to be some sort of an atmosphere for water to exist in, because without an atmosphere, water just boils off in space. You can take hot water in a syringe and plug up the front end of the syringe, doesn't have a needle on it, and draw back the plunger, and warm water at low pressure will boil, because you have to have pressure, a certain pressure, to keep water in a liquid form. And so what God did was separate water from water, and in between was the expanse. And so he's got water below, an expanse, which is a space, and then water above. And there are several thoughts about what exactly are the waters above. One is that the waters above are clouds, and that the atmosphere is the expanse. And so then you have water vapor that make clouds. Another idea is that higher than the clouds, the temperature of the atmosphere gets very hot, and it can hold lots of water up at that altitude. And so another thought is that this God separated the waters from waters, and the waters above are actually a liquid or a water vapor canopy around the earth. And that had certain advantages. It would have protected life from lots of radiation. It would have created high pressure on our atmosphere. It would have created a uniform temperature around the earth. And it would have given a source for a lot of water in the flood when that canopy was to collapse. And another idea from Russ Humphreys is that the waters above, or actually above the atmosphere, and went further out when God stretched out the heavens, and are at the edge of the universe. And so there's waters above that are above the what God called the firmament or the expanse. And so you have the problem of water vapor and canopy water vapor, and clouds are within the atmosphere, not above it. And if the atmosphere is the expanse, well, you got what's above it. So anyway, that's an interesting question. But God certainly made this happen by the action of His will. He stretched out this whatever He had created. This expanse, and however far out it went, and verse 14 beyond talks about how He made the lights, the sun, moon, and stars to be in the firmament of the heavens, because in verse 8 He calls the firmament heaven. And that word in Hebrew is a plural word. In fact, it does not have a singular form. And so the translator could have said heavens here. In fact, and he does in the next verse. And so we have expanse here, and expanse here. So we're in within these 6, 7, and 8, these three verses, can we kind of agree that this firmament/expanse is the same? We're talking about the same thing, right? It's the same structure that God created. And for practical purposes, that represents the atmosphere on Earth. And so that atmosphere is, as we're building a case, specially designed to shelter and protect us and give us certain things that we absolutely need. And so let's watch this couple of minute video about sort of some of the characteristics of the atmosphere.
Oxygen is the signature of complex life. If you're gonna have complex life needing a lot of energy anywhere in the universe, you're gonna have to use oxygen.
But for oxygen to be available for use, you need the right kind of planet and the right kind of atmosphere.
And you can only get atmospheres containing oxygen on planets roughly the size of the Earth. If they're too big, they retain primeval gases such as hydrogen and helium. If they're too small, they lose all their atmosphere. So you have to have planets roughly this size.
Getting the oxygen we need for life involves a stunning series of coincidences. On our planet, plants utilize the energy of sunlight to manufacture sugars and other essential organic compounds by a process known as photosynthesis. Photosynthesis converts radiant energy from the sun into a form of stored chemical energy that plants can use. But along the way, photosynthesis also generates an important waste product, oxygen. In other words, the same process that supplies the energy plants need just happens to also produce a waste product that supplies energy to humans and many other animals. If that weren't amazing enough, photosynthesis must have access to just the right kind of energy in order to work.
And what energy does the photosynthesis need? It's the very small region of the electromagnetic spectrum, which is the visual region. This is the region which powers photosynthesis. In fact, it's light. Light energy. Light energy has the correct characteristics to raise the atoms of organic chemistry to levels for chemical interactions. So light is the right electromagnetic energy for photosynthesis. When you look at the sun, you find the sun turns out nearly all of its energy in the visible spectrum. So the sun is pouring out just the energy you need for photosynthesis. And so the radiant energy output of the sun happens to be in exactly the same region of the electromagnetic spectrum that you need for photosynthesis.
The Earth's atmosphere has just the right composition to allow the visible light we need to reach the surface of the planet, while largely absorbing many other kinds of radiation that are dangerous to life.
There are an awesome set of coincidences in the atmosphere which happen to allow the light of the sun to come right down to the surface of the Earth where it can empower photosynthesis, where miraculously the atmosphere blocks out lots of other forms of radiation and allows the life-giving light to get to the planetary surface to allow photosynthesis to occur so you can have oxygen. But the amazing thing about the window in the atmosphere is UV, gamma radiation, dangerous radiations are blocked out. And so the light of the sun comes right down to the Earth where oxygen can be manufactured.
Other coincidences allow just the right amount of oxygen to exist in our atmosphere, but not more.
We need a lot of oxygen. We need 250 mils of oxygen every minute. As you're sitting there, you're breathing there, relaxing, you're using up 250 mils of oxygen every minute. It's incredible. That's the amount of oxygen you need to maintain your energy levels. And to get this amount of oxygen, you need to take it from an atmosphere. And you need about 20% or so oxygen in the atmosphere to get sufficient to feed your metabolic needs.
The problem with needing so much oxygen in the atmosphere is that oxygen is dangerous because it's so reactive. If you have too much of it in the atmosphere, you can have spontaneous combustion. Fortunately, the form of oxygen prevalent in our lower atmosphere is diatomic. That means two atoms of oxygen typically combine together into a molecule. Diatomic oxygen happens to be much less reactive so long as the temperature is below 50 degrees centigrade or 122 degrees Fahrenheit.
And this allows, in fact, quite a high level of oxygen in the atmosphere without spontaneous combustion.
Okay, we're talking about miraculous coincidences, aren't we? That 93 million miles away is a star we call the sun. And it gives out a massive amount of energy. And that energy ranges from, you know, ultraviolet to way past infrared, it's gamma ray to radio waves and everything. But this little spectrum of visible light, 400 to 700 nanometers, is the majority of the output from our sun. And all the way here on this planet, 93 million miles away, there are plants that have chemicals within them that can absorb exactly that wavelength of light from the sun and use it to energize making sugars and making oxygen. Now, oxygen is not a waste product from, he called it a waste product. Wrong. It's a product of photosynthesis, as is sugar. And of course, we eat plants and we eat animals that eat plants. And we'll talk a little more about plants in a moment. But the key thing is that there's this coherence of the sun and what is on Earth, and then the biochemical processes exist to capture that sunlight and use it productively to make biochemical sugar. And that's how most 99.9% of life gets its energy on the Earth, is in that process. And the ability of the light to get here is dependent on the transparency of the atmosphere. Right? If it's, we've had these fires out in California, and maybe you've seen some of the dust and stuff that's blown through. We were in Denver recently, and it was very hazy because of the wildfires. And if there's dew point and temperatures are such, you can have fog on the ground. You can have impairment of visibility in the atmosphere. But by and large, God has so constructed our atmosphere that it is transparent to the energy that we need. And even our skin is photosynthetic. So we make vitamin D from our skin. And that is an important part of the ability of our bodies to take up calcium to build our bones. And if we live in a box with artificial light and never get any natural light, we're going to end up vitamin D deficient and calcium deficient and osteoporotic, because our bones won't be able to build calcium in the right way. So God made us to live in the light outside, and he made our skin in such a way that it would use that energy to make a vital part of our physiology. We can't make sugars the way plants can, but plants do the work of concentrating this diffuse energy from the sun into something like an apple that we can eat and enjoy. And that is concentration of energy that now we would otherwise need to go through something rather spectacular to gather. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. And also, water is transparent to light by and large, again, unless there's sediment suspended in it. But there's lots of photosynthetic things in the ocean, that cyanobacteria, and they make like 2/3 of the oxygen, you know, for on our planet, just themselves. All right, so the atmosphere has a particular design: 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, little bit of some of the noble gases, xenon, argon, that sort of thing. And then there's a little bit of carbon dioxide, a little bit of helium, a little bit of water as vapor. But its design has certain functions. It's transparent, right? Allows the right energy to reach the surface. It has a combination of elements, of atoms, of elements, of gases that provide requirements for us. So it's got oxygen as a diatomic O2 that we breathe, but it also provides carbon dioxide for plants to use to produce sugars, but then they produce oxygen as well. And so there's this dependence of our form of life on plant life that is not accidental. We make what they need, they make what we need, right? Oxygen, carbon dioxide, right? And this ratio is really useful, because if you have higher than 20% oxygen levels, then you start to risk lots of fires. Things can spontaneously combust, or a lightning strike can cause a massive fire that you can't control in a high oxygen environment. And the pressure of the atmosphere is actually tuned to, you know, what our lungs can handle. So if we go up in the atmosphere or into space, we need to take oxygen at our, you know, sea level pressure with us. We can survive up to, you know, several thousand meters in height Even climbing Mount Everest, you can do without exogenous oxygen, carrying oxygen, but you're in a death zone up there. You really can't stay up there very long. And so our lungs are designed to function at a certain pressure. And if we go down in the ocean, every fathom, every 10 feet, 6 to 10 feet, is another atmosphere of pressure. And so if you go down 100 feet, that's 10 times the pressure of the atmosphere. And you have to have a regulator on your compressed air tank to change that pressure into pressure that your lungs can use. So we are designed to live at the bottom of an ocean of air. And it has a huge capacity to hold water and to move heat around the planet, around the world. This is why on the edges of continents, the temperatures are pretty mild and they don't get extreme. They don't get extremely hot, they don't get extremely cold because they're buffered by these huge oceans on the coasts. And it provides stability for our overall air temperature. And you know, we've got enough water vapor to support 37.5 million billion gallons up in the atmosphere, and that is fresh water, because 70% of the world is ocean water, which is salt water. It's not drinkable water for us. But God has provided this idea of not only springs from underneath the ground, but evaporation and rain now post-flood for fresh water, and that is exactly what we need to survive. And these cycles, these hydrologic cycles, water evaporates, rains, and then runs down through and causes erosion and runs down and brings that material down through the rivers down into the ocean. And you harvest it, Dave does, as sand as it comes down. So it causes a lot of erosion. But and that's one of those things about, well, can the Earth be 14.7 billion years old, or can the continents be billions of years old? Well, probably not. If they have a certain rate of erosion, they would have been eroded a long time ago. All right, so let's go on to day three. Genesis 1, 9 through 13. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. So here we go. It's like, this is good. This is the way I want it to be. I'm satisfied that we have an atmosphere. We have liquid water, and we're gonna very shortly have solid land. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass." So let's talk about this for just a second. The gathering together of the waters reveals the continent. It was a single continent. And even today, you can look at the shapes of our continents and you can put them together like a puzzle, and they fit together. And this is called plate tectonics. The idea is that the continents are less dense than the rock that's below them, and so they don't sit on it, they float on the rock that's below them, because the rock below them is somewhat plastic because it's hot. And so there is this continent, there was probably a single continent, since the water was gathered together essentially in one place. That meant that the ocean, the land, where there was a single landmass, and that landmass was broken up, we believe, at the worldwide flood, and moved very quickly to the current positions. And what we're seeing now in sort of the movement of the continents apart from each other, which is called seafloor spreading, as you see the seafloor coming up and going out, pushing the continents a little further, is just the little end result, the little ending shifts of the flood that 4,500 years ago caused this major upheaval in the world and broke apart this continent into these pieces that now we look at as our continents. So God said, now that we have earth and dry earth, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seeds, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was so. All right, so this is the beginning of biology. This is the first biological life. Plants are an absolute miracle of biochemistry, right? For a cell to have figured out how to be photosynthetic, it's just, there's like 2,000 different proteins involved in photosynthesis, arranged in light reactions and dark reactions, arranged in what are called photosystems, multiple photosystems, and electron transport chains to a final, what's called an electron receptor, which is oxygen, and to create these sugars, to capture the energy in a chemical bond of between carbon atoms in sugar. That is a miracle of biochemistry. It's horribly complex, but it works because God designed it to work. And he knew how to put it together. Again, I didn't make it. I don't maintain it. I just can figure out through science how it works and come to appreciate the mind of God in that way. And he brings forth grass and herbs that yield seed and fruit trees, you know, green growing plants. Grass, around the world, grass supports unbelievable numbers of land animals who eat grass. And they then are prey for carnivores. And this is the beginning of the ecosystem, but this interconnected web of life begins with plants, and I might add bacteria in the soil that have an intimate relationship with plants. For instance, legumes like beans in their roots have nodules in them that has a bacterium in it that will take nitrogen out of the air and fix it into the soil. This is why farmers rotate their crops, right? And one year you're going to have beans or some sort of a legume, and you are replenishing the nitrogen in your soil by doing that, as well as growing beans. And so there are these interconnected processes and interconnections of living things that depend on each other for life to higher levels of life to exist, levels like us. Why? Because we can't be photosynthetic. If I was a green plant, I would die, I would wither in a day. Because in order for me to have 2,000 calories versus energy from the sun, I would have to have a solar panel and carry this around with me that was 6 feet wide and 32 feet long. And I would have to have that panel oriented to the sun the entire time. Well, that's 200 square feet. That's about 20 square meters. And if I had to carry that around, I couldn't do it. My skin surface area is about 2 square meters, 1.8, 1.9, 2 square meters. That's all I have in terms of skin. And if I had to be green, have chloroplasts in my skin, I would only be able to show the sun half of my skin at a time, right? And I'd flip over. And you couldn't get enough energy from the sun as a photosynthetic being. So I have to depend on photosynthesis to concentrate that energy into fruit, nuts, leaves that I can eat, or into animals that eat those vegetation, and then I eat the animals who are very rich in their protein and energy sources for me. But I just cannot do it. I couldn't be a photosynthetic being the way a plant is. And so God created this, he brought forth things that will supply our needs, and who has life in seeds. So here we go about the idea that God created different kinds of plants. And these would yield fruit according to their kind. So fig trees don't bear apples. Apple trees don't bear pears, right? They're all trees. They're all photosynthetic, but they don't have each other's fruit because they're different kinds of trees. Now, a tree kind is okay, but you know, there's going to be certain types of trees that they don't cross-fertilize, right? You can't put, pear trees next to apple trees and have them cross-fertilize because it just doesn't work. So that tells me that they're different kinds. And this was also in whatever, you know, kind of other growing plant or grass or flowers. They're of certain kinds that are genetically bounded, and they don't cross-fertilize. There are some plants that hybridize quite nicely with other plants, and those would then be in the same created kind. So we think of things that are we're not talking about species. Species is something that is a human sort of design specific term for one population of something that doesn't breed with another population. But when you take, you know, a lion and a tiger, they're different species, but they can breed and form what's called a liger. and so they're the same biological biblical kind, right, of cats. And so that's what God has begun here, is creating living things that will supply the needs of other organisms and us. And of course, he had his way. And with a seed that is the kernel of life, whose job is just simply to survive until it germinates. We just planted grass seed in the corners of our yard. It's been 6 days I've been watering twice a day to get this to stay dry, and finally the seeds germinate, and from last night to today, it's like, you know, all of a sudden it's green. It's amazing the swiftness of the growth. And so we think that this creation event was either really quick growth or an instantaneous event of God simply creating a mature plant, a mature living thing, in a way that it would normally function with seeds, with seeds in itself, to then become a self-sustaining kind of an organism. And plants, as you know, if you take a pile of dirt, within a week, there's going to be weeds and onions and weird things growing in that pile of dirt because the seeds blow in, and they get carried in by animals. And God has designed plants and life to spread around the world. And so the earth brought forth this photosynthetic miracle and yielding seeds according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, blah, 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 according to its kind, and God saw it was good, right? So having dry land was good, and having this miracle of photosynthetic living things that are, they're not biblically alive, but they're biologically alive, is a good thing. And that was an evening and morning of the third day. Now, the ecosystems that we're talking about, whether, you know, post-flood, there's all these different sort of ecosystems around the world of desert and, treed areas and temperate areas and areas around the equator, equatorial areas. These are more diverse than there was when God first created the world. But he created the world, as we saw, 93 million miles from Earth. And this is the Earth down here inside of this sort of weird bubble. And 93 million miles, and the problem is that's awfully close to a star. And what happens is the star shoots out parts of this plasma that's on its surface, and it goes in all directions, but sometimes it goes towards Earth, and it comes towards Earth at the speed of light. I mean, it goes really fast. And it takes a little while to get here. Actually slower than the speed of light, because it would take 8 minutes if it were the speed of light, and it takes actually 2 or 3 days to get here. This is a plasma coronal mass ejection. And so we live inside of a bubble that protects us from that harmful exposure of stuff from the sun. And this is called the magnetosphere, because the Earth functions as a huge magnet. And we have a North Pole and a South Pole. And the lines come out from the South Pole, and they go up, and they come in the North Pole. And that's what you're seeing here, these sort of concentric lines of the North Pole and the South Pole. And we're not quite sure how this is generated. We think, you know, obviously, if you're a physicist, you know that a changing electrical current produces a magnetic field. And so this magnetic field is caused by changing electrical currents deep in the Earth, probably within the edges of the core. But it continuously changes and moves, and that creates this huge magnetic field around the Earth that buffers it from this harmful mass. And if you live towards the South Pole, which nobody does except some scientists, or you get to go up at higher latitudes, you can see maybe the auroras, right? The aurora borealis, or the aurora in the South Pole. And these come from these charged particles that come from the sun that are deflected to the poles so that they don't get to us. And God has provided this bubble for all of these ecosystems and for us to live in. And this is sort of it's kind of like solar wind. So the wind comes from the sun and moves our magnetic field out into sort of a tail on the downwind side, sort of magnetic of the electrical sun wind. So anyway, that's another aspect that people are not generally aware of. And we talked about how seeds have life in themselves. And if you like dandelions, you will like this video. But if you fight dandelions in your yard and your neighbor doesn't really do anything to their dandelions, it's a real losing battle. And you'll see why as we think about just
guidance is internal.
About
ignition
seeds.
Sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
You're watching the launch of 1,000 flying machines, each exquisitely crafted to airdrop life throughout the Earth. A dandelion puff exists for one crucial purpose: to disperse the flower's seeds as far as possible from the parent plant. Its component parts are well suited for the task. Dozens of individual seeds are attached to the head of this flower. Each is covered with microscopic hooks that will eventually help anchor them to fertile soil. A thin stem elevates a cluster of bristles called the pappus, and these filaments are engineered to respond to variations in the weather. On a rainy morning, the moist, heavy air makes extended flight all but impossible. Every pappus reacts by closing tightly. But later in the day, when the air dries out and the temperature warms, the reaction is quickly reversed in preparation for takeoff. Under optimal conditions, a seed can stay aloft for more than 10 miles. At the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, a team of engineers discovered how these tiny mechanisms fly so well. Using a vertical wind tunnel, they photographed the dynamics of airflow around the seed. When currents passed between the bristles, a swirling whirlpool called a vortex ring
formed just above the pappus. In nature, this pocket of low pressure sucks the parachute upward and stabilizes its movement as it's carried by the wind. Other studies have also revealed that the vortex's shape and ability to maintain its position are determined by the size and quantity of the bristles and the amount of empty space between them. Simulation models demonstrate that in a biological structure this small, the finely tuned airflow required for flight is the product of circular geometry with 92% open space and 100 thread-like filaments. Not surprisingly, that's the blueprint for the pappus of a typical dandelion seed. How well does this technology work? When compared to a conventional parachute, the pappus is at least 4 times more efficient at maintaining altitude and slowing the seed's descent to Earth. Innovation, foresight, and world-class engineering, all displayed in living wonders so common and familiar, we pass them by each day without a glance or second thought.
If you think about the care with which God engineered even a dandelion seed, it's just amazing. And he cares for you and how he designed you to be who you are and how you function and what is required for your needs. God has provided everything that we need on the earth, and he has taken such care with a simple seed. How much more valuable are you than a seed of a dandelion? And these seeds are necessary because the dandelion plant is stuck in the ground. It can't move. So something has to move, and it's the seeds. And surely, you know, fruit drops from the tree. Animals eat the fruit, and they take it places. There are burrs that end up in animals' fur, and they get moved in various places. There are even seeds that have to pass through the acid environment of the stomach of an animal before they'll even germinate. But God, you know, put all this together. But he provided life with a mechanism to grow, multiply, and fill the earth, and that was his charge eventually, as we'll see. All right, is time? I'm going to skip this one, and we're going to go on to the cosmos.
Day 4. Can we have some
Day 4.
Lights back there? Ethan, are you back there? There you go. We're going to do one more segment, and then we'll take a break at about 8 o'clock, which is on your program, maybe 8:05. Going to introduce Dave Penny. Dave Penny's an Emporia boy. Y'all, some of you with a little age on you, remember those red cement trucks that used to drive around? That's his family. And Dave is married to Carmen, who's over here, and they have 5 children.
Concrete, not cement.
Excuse me, concrete. Okay, concrete. Thank you, David Hoover. And one thing you need to know about Dave, other than he went to MIT in mechanical engineering, and he went to Dallas Seminary, and he's majored in Hebrew and Greek a long time ago, is that he was an evolutionist, and now he is a young earth creationist. David, you got... you're on the clock.
Okay, appreciate it.
All right, 25 minutes. We'll take a break.
What you've had in the first 3 days of creation is a preparation for life here on the earth. You have the light, first day. Second day is dividing the waters above from the waters below using the atmosphere. And the waters above don't exist today, but they would have created an atmosphere here which would give you a uniform temperature over the earth. It's like Venus next to us has a canopy. It's not made out of water particularly. It's mainly CO2, but it gives you a uniform temperature, which would explain why we have the largest coal beds in the world in Antarctica out of tropical plants, and at the North Pole in Siberia, these things. God's preparing the things, and then with day three, he took the waters below and divided them in dry land and seas and planted plants there. Okay, so what we're going to see in the next 3 days is putting things into those. The light that I'm going to talk about is then populated with what? Sun, moon, and stars. The fifth day is linked to the second day. You have the creation of the waters above, the firmament, and the waters below. It's a preparation for your birds to fly, it says, across the face of the firmament, and for the sea creatures. And then the third day was creating the plants and the dry land for the animals that are going to come on the sixth day, including us. What's amazing, though, to me is since I was a kid, I was trained in, well, I worked in the Apollo project to put the men on the moon. My training at MIT was oriented toward that. They kept us out. It turned out that the space program was a part of the Cold War, and they could put up satellites in 1957. They could drop bombs on us, and they tested all of us, and that was they kept us out of even the Vietnam War so we could develop that. But what I was always fascinated from the beginning was the universe. Most of us don't realize how big the universe is that we live in. And it's on this day, and it says, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And so it was. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. In other words, the sun for the day and the moons for night. Then you're going to get into something really. And he made the stars also. That's a compliment. You'd say, an afterthought? Created the stars? What we have here on the earth is nothing compared to the magnitude of the universe. And we'll talk a little bit about the size of that. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to rule the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God said it was good. And it was an evening and a morning, a fourth day. Let's go on to... How big is the universe? It says in Isaiah 40, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or the breadth of his hand has marked out the heavens? It's huge. There think now that there are 10 trillion galaxies. We live in one galaxy called the Milky Way. How many stars do you think are in the Milky Way? 200 billion, just in ours. In other words, they think there's 7 billion people on the face of the earth. That means that there's 30 stars for every man, woman, and child on the earth, just in our galaxy. And if you have 10 trillion galaxies, the average size they estimate is 100 billion stars in each one of those. So how many stars are there? That's 10 to the 24th, that number. That's 10 trillion galaxies, each with 100 billion stars, and it goes out to, that's one with 24 zeros behind it of stars. And those stars are approximately the same size as our sun. Can you believe that? We're living on around one star, of which there are 200 billion stars, and we're living on one planet. Around this one star. This thing, do you know how much energy is involved in that? To create that? And we'll talk later about the problem of the size of this deal, and that's what kills the Big Bang Theory, by the way, is the size and magnitude. Even if you could have a Big Bang, it's not possible to put it out there in 20 billion years. or any of it goes out. We have the Hubble satellite telescope up above. They concentrate, you're going to see later, the power of it to look out, and you cannot see the end of space. The galaxies get bigger, smaller and smaller and smaller, and they disappear. What you know about that is that the Big Bang, and my roommate was the one that did the equations for going around the moon for the Apollo project. He's the one that does the interplanetary stuff. He can't even leave the country. He's under lockdown by their government. I spoke in the Ukraine to a big conference 3 years ago, and I said, hey, Bob, come along with me. He says, they won't let me go. I said, why? He said, I can't visit any former Soviet country, and if anyone talks to me about anything, I've got to file a report. There are certain people they keep locked down. But he did the equations for going around the moon and for landing on the moon. He does the ones for the interplanetary shots out to Saturn, Pluto, out to the end, and on beyond that with Voyagers, the Voyager satellites and the others. So this is how big we're looking at. And it's one statement, and he made the stars also. Do you realize what we're dealing with here when we talk about God? And he says, even the hairs on our head, he's concerned with. What being could be capable of worrying about the hairs on my head? You can see I don't have very many of them left. And he's concerned about them. And yet he's created all these stars. These stars, from the pictures of, I don't have the time here to show you of the Hubble, they're stunning. The stars in complexity are unbelievable. Our planets are unbelievable. Saturn, Jupiter, all those. But these are stars. And we see in our galaxy alone, about every day or two, one of them blowing up. They call them novas. And every once in a while, about once a year, we see a supernova. It's not in our galaxy. It's in another one. And for the first time in the last 2 years, they've been able to take a picture of the nearest galaxy to us where we can actually see stars. The other galaxies are too far away, and there's too many of them to see any of the stars in the other galaxies. We finally have seen one in another one. That's why we know what this number is of 100 billion.
These are fingerprints of adult human beings. Each measures approximately 1/2 by 3/4 of an inch. Now, you're probably wondering why this information is of any significance. Well, when coupled with some of the greatest astronomy in history, the tip of your finger can help reveal a breathtaking perspective of the universe. Just stay with me for a minute, and I think you'll see what I mean. In April 1990, the Space Shuttle Discovery transported and positioned the Hubble Space Telescope 350 miles from Earth. There, orbiting above the turbulence of our atmosphere, the Hubble has captured unprecedented views of the universe for the past 3 decades. Its gallery includes planets and nebulae, galactic collisions, supernovas, and extraordinary surveys of deep space that have opened new doors to understanding the size and structure of the cosmos. On May 2, 2019, an international team of astronomers released a new Hubble image that captured the imagination of the world. They called it the Hubble Legacy Field. For 250 days, over a period of 16 years, the telescope was aimed at one sliver of sky near the Fornax constellation in the southern hemisphere. In all, 7,500 exposures of this region of space, long thought to be relatively empty, were captured by the Hubble cameras. Later, they were assembled into the most detailed view of the cosmos ever explored. At least 265,000 galaxies were documented, including many so faint and distant their light measured just 1/10 billionth of the brightness the human eye can see. Okay, now here's where your fingertip comes into play. From Earth, you can cover the entire area photographed by the Hubble astronomers, including its estimated 265,000 galaxies, with the tip of your index finger held at arm's length. And that section of space we just blocked out? It represents our view of about 1/240,000th of the entire night sky. The implications are humbling. For almost every one of those 240,000 fingertip-sized parcels of sky includes at least 250,000 galaxies. Wow.
The secular people, and I used to be one of them, would say, they're trying to explain these stars and these galaxies and the universe without a God. And these are two quotes from Stephen Hawking. Many of you know him. In this called The Great Design, he says, "Bodies such as the stars and black holes cannot appear out of nothing, but the universe can." Isn't that a crazy thing? Even these little parts of the universe can't appear out of nothing, but the whole universe did? Out of a black hole? By the way, I was talking to my roommate. He didn't become a Christian until about 15 years ago. I became a Christian at MIT. I talked to him. We were very close. We rode the nationals together and everything, and he's a powerhouse. Probably the best that exists on Earth to this day on doing these calculations and doing these interplanetary probes. He said that this thing is, the Big Bang violates every law of physics. When you have an explosion, you have to have a conservation of momentum. There has to be an equal amount going in every direction. The universe is lumpy. There's no place you can put and have an equal amount moving in any direction. He says it gets even worse. You cannot get from an explosion rotary motion in space. It's all going out radially in every direction. And yet, everything in the universe has to be in rotary motion. Do you know why? Otherwise, the big bodies suck up the small ones. You have to balance the gravitational pull and the centripetal forces that keep it in orbit. We've put up 10,000 satellites, and they always come down or go off. Why? Because we can't calculate them accurately enough to put them in orbit. And that's only a two-body system, the Earth and the satellite. We cannot do the calculations for more than a 5- or 6-body system. And if we could do it, how do you put them into orbit if you can't even do the calculations? Our solar system is a 100-body system, 9 planets and 90 moons. Now, if you could do it, you can't even do the mathematics. And that's only one star system. How do you put the galaxies in orbit so that the big bodies don't suck up the small ones? How do you put them in stable orbits? And most of the universe is in stable orbits. But you can't get that out of a Big Bang. None of these things will work. What you have is God has created things in place with great diversity and with a beauty of engineering. We can't even do it for one solar system. But here's what they say. Dawkins, you know who he is, the famous atheist? He says it's common sense that you can't get something out of nothing. Something pretty mysterious had to have given rise to the origin of life in the universe. It's out of nothing. Their theories are. It doesn't happen. This is the admissions of atheists. We have the law of cause and effect. for every material effect, the cause has to be greater than the effect that is before it. For instance, none of you can do anything greater. In fact, your genetic material can't produce a super being. And you can't take a bacteria and the DNA in it and produce a human. It doesn't have enough information. The cause always has to be greater than the effect that it produces. Here's a...
Same year, Time featured its now famous headline, the astronomer Carl Sagan announced that there were two necessary criteria for a planet to support life: the right kind of star and a planet the right distance from that star. Given the roughly octillion planets in the universe, that's one followed by 24 zeros, there should have been about septillion planets, that's one followed by 21 zeros, capable of supporting life. With such spectacular odds, scientists were optimistic that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, known by its initials SETI, an ambitious project launched in the 1960s, was sure to turn up something soon. With a vast radio telescopic network, scientists listened for signals that resembled coded intelligence. But as the years passed, the silence from the universe was deafening. As of 2014, researchers have discovered precisely bupkis, nada, zilch, which is to say zero, followed by an infinite number of zeros. What happened? As our knowledge of the universe increased, it became clear that there were, in fact, far more factors necessary for life, let alone intelligent life, than Sagan supposed. His two parameters grew to 10, then 20, and then 50, which meant that the number of potentially life-supporting planets decreased accordingly. The number dropped to a few thousand planets and kept on plummeting. Even SETI proponents acknowledged the problem. Peter Schenkel wrote in a 2006 piece for Skeptical Inquirer, a magazine that strongly affirms atheism, "In light of new findings and insights, we should quietly admit that the early estimates may no longer be tenable." Today, there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. For example, without a massive gravity-rich planet like Jupiter nearby to draw away asteroids, Earth would be more like an interstellar dartboard than the verdant orb that it is. Simply put, the odds against life in the universe are astonishing. Yet, here we are, not only existing, but talking about existing. What can account for it? Can every one of those many parameters have been perfectly met by accident? At what point is it fair to admit that it is science itself that suggests that we cannot be the result of random forces? Doesn't assuming that an intelligence created these perfect conditions in fact require far less faith than believing that a life-sustaining Earth just happened to beat the inconceivable odds? But wait, there's more. The fine-tuning necessary for life to exist on a planet is nothing compared with the fine-tuning required for the universe to exist at all. For example, astrophysicists now know that the values of the four fundamental forces, gravity, the electromagnetic force, and the strong and weak nuclear forces, were determined less than 1/1,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang. Alter any one of these four values ever so slightly, and the universe as we know it could not exist. For instance, if the ratio between the strong nuclear force and the electromagnetic force had been off by the tiniest fraction of the tiniest inconceivable fraction, then no stars could have formed at all. Multiply that single parameter by all the other necessary conditions, and the odds against the universe existing are so heart-stoppingly astronomical that the notion that it all just happened defies common sense. It would be like tossing a coin and having it come up heads 10 quintillion times in a row. I don't think so. Fred Hoyle, the astronomer who coined the term Big Bang, said that his atheism was greatly shaken by these developments. One of the world's most renowned theoretical physicists, Paul Davies, has said that the appearance of design is overwhelming. Even the late Christopher Hitchens, one of atheism's most aggressive proponents, conceded that without question, the fine-tuning argument was the most powerful argument of the other side. Oxford University professor of mathematics, Dr. John Lennox, has said, "The more we get to know about our universe, the more the hypothesis that there is a creator gains in credibility as the best explanation of why we are here." The greatest miracle of all time is the universe. It is the miracle of all miracles, one that inescapably points to something or someone beyond itself.
Well, we're out of time, but I want to and we're going to pick up some of these points later, too. The cause and effect, for every material effect, the cause is greater, as we said, than that, and that the cause for the material universe must then be something that was non-material, outside of the universe. It has to be outside of the natural laws. It's not affected by the laws of science. It violates them all. And it has to be above the natural laws and higher in power than the material universe itself. This all comes down to Romans 10, 1, which says, For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, those are invisible things, are seen by the things that are visible, so that they are without excuse.